Welcome to Boston Confidential, Beantown's true crime podcast. Boston is a great city, but there's more to it than the Freedom Trail and Fenway Park. There's a startling underbelly to the city, and Boston Confidential will take you on a guided tour of the hub of the universe, Boston, Massachusetts. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Boston Confidential. My name's Barry McGuire, and I'm your host. I'm a 20-year private investigator on the streets of Boston, and I help run a company called Impact Due Diligence Investigations. If you need anything in terms of investigative services, feel free to contact me at Impact. If I can't help you personally, I'll certainly direct you to the right person or agency. All right, guys, let's get to it. Hey, guys, welcome back to Boston Confidential. I just wanted to touch base. It's Monday, May 13th, and we're covering the Karen Reed trial. And man, I'm flummoxed. Brian Albert just got off the stand and may have actually committed perjury on a few counts, I think. I'm a little shaken up over his testimony, quite frankly. This went so bad for the Commonwealth, guys. I don't know if everybody has the opportunity to watch it, but it's left me like shaken, like that this guy can openly lie on the stand. And it seems as though he has committed perjury or is close to committing perjury. Again, I'm not an attorney, but we have paramedic McLaughlin, who David Yannetti has asked be charged with perjury in this case because she refused to admit to being friends with Caitlin Albert. And that's Brian Albert and McLaughlin. And don't forget, Michael Proctor lied by saying that he had no relationship with the Alberts and the McCabes. That's been thoroughly disproven, and he also may be charged with perjury. I don't know how this case continues. It's a train wreck. They're going to come back for redirect on Brian Albert, but I urge you to go watch the cross-examination of Brian Albert. He has been destroyed. He lied in the other grand jury. He lied in the state grand jury, and he lied here today. And I'll get into more of specifically what he lied about. But man, I just can't believe it. They came out with something in particular where in previous testimony, Brian Albert stated that he had never met Karen Reed, but the defense produced pictures 6 days before John died. Brian Albert and the whole crew, Chris Albert was there, and they ask Brian Albert, who took this photo? It was at a different bar than they had been on the night John died. Brian Albert states, I don't know who took the photograph. And Jackson kind of motions to his left where Karen Reed is and says, Karen Reed took that photograph, didn't she? Man, it's kind of a blockbuster. So that also kind of implicates Chris Albert because he stated basically he didn't really know Karen. And same type of thing as, you know, Brian Albert's testimony, just trying to distance themselves. And I think they both may have perjured themselves in this instance. It's not going well, and I don't know why the judge isn't more upset. I'd call both lawyers into chambers and say, Mr. Lally, I've had several witnesses now lie and at least creep up to the border of perjury in this case. What the hell's going on? Maybe she's done that. It's not public, but it doesn't seem it from her demeanor. She is wholly on the side of the prosecution. And with Brian Albert, she really couldn't help him that much. It was a bloodbath. So again, guys, I urge you to watch the cross-examination of Brian Albert. I really don't know where to begin. There's just so much here. He, I believe, killed the Commonwealth's case. It was dying as we approached Brian Albert, but he killed it. And I know Brian Albert in this sense isn't the police because he wasn't, you know, active as a police officer. But how do you believe anything, you know, from the prosecution side at this point? it's a weird dichotomy here where the defense seems to be the party looking for the truth, and prosecution is obfuscating, denying, distancing. They want to get away from the truth. And since opening arguments, we really haven't had anybody point the finger. I guess the paramedics pointed the finger a little bit when Karen was saying, did I hit him? Could I have hit him? Or I hit him. I think that was thoroughly rebuffed in front of the jury because this woman was in total shock and panic. She had just finished giving CPR to the man she loved, and she was still covered in his blood. And they're going to try to hold her to these statements, which seem inaccurate because people who were with the person who was testifying, like paramedic McLaughlin, I think her testimony saying, I hit him, was basically, I don't want to say thoroughly refuted, but refuted. My only concern is during those times with the paramedics, the jury heard repeatedly that Karen said she hit him. But at various times, there's a question mark at the end of that. And I think when we see the defense put on their case in totality, they'll cover that. They'll cover her grief, anguish, and everything else. But in terms of Brian Albert, there's just so much there. The first thing that just seems absurd to me, I think if I was on a jury, and it should to you, Brian Albert never came out of his house when there was fire trucks, ambulances, police, screaming, talking. Just after Brian Albert's testimony on Twitter and Facebook, people are posting photographs that neighbors took of the Alberts' house, and it's brighter than Christmas time, you know, at one of those tour houses where you go look at the lights. I find it absolutely absurd and impossible that anyone slept through that. These sirens are just feet, literally feet, from your bedroom window. And Brian Albert said he never heard anything. His wife never heard anything. It's complete and utter bullshit because it just goes against common sense. It just goes against common sense. And I think the jury picks up on that. So you and your wife are both dead sleepers. Come on. And you didn't wake up until like 6:30 when Jen came into the house. But even then, they didn't go out. I know John had been transported by this point, I think. And you still don't come out to say, geez, what happened? Talk to the cops involved, something, anything. All you get is nothing, absolutely nothing. And it's just not believable. It is not believable. I think some of the most damaging testimony to the Commonwealth, and it was all pretty damaging, but specifically, it came out, and we had known this, we knew it was coming, but the jury didn't, that Brian Albert destroyed his cell phone after being ordered not to by Judge Beverly. Can you believe that? And they go back and forth of when he was notified, and coincidentally, the day before he says he was notified that he could not destroy, alter the data on his phone or destroy the data in any way, he turned his phone and he upgraded his phone. And he had the damnedest time trying to explain it. I don't believe it. I believed he was informed or it was leaked to him that they were going to get the phones. That they're going to get the phone data. That's why he did it. It was a calculated risk. Do I face admonishment for destroying a phone when I wasn't supposed to, or give him all this incriminating data? And he chose the former, you know? He wasn't giving up that data. It came out that Brian Higgins, his, I guess, his best friend, also destroyed his telephone. So if you're on the jury, you've got two people destroying their phones during a homicide investigation. It didn't look good. It didn't go over well. And it was like a bombshell in the courtroom. Having these people, especially this guy, Brian Higgins, who's not related to the Alberts. And I think it dawned on Brian Higgins pretty soon when this started to go south that he's not family. And that's when he began talking to the federal government on this, right? And that's about where we are now. He kind of abandoned the Alberts and the McCabes after that. And I think that was on the advice of the FBI. So I believe in some of the earliest reports, it was stated that Brian Albert just went to bed, never woke up during this, you know, circus on his front lawn. And this brings us to Chloe, the dog, who has been described as kind of vicious with strangers. He had sent two people, I believe, to the emergency room. And during this time frame, when this is all going on, and I'm talking 10, 12 feet from the front door, Brian Albert's testimony is the dog didn't bark. Listen, that's just horseshit. And I know not every dog's the same, but I've got a big goofy dog who is good with people. But if somebody drives up our driveway, you're going to hear about it, right? You're going to hear about it inside the house, and that's a good thing. I don't believe for a second that that dog was not going nuts. Absolutely nuts. At one time, you probably had 15 people on that lawn. You had Karen Reed doing CPR. You had the paramedics. There was screaming. It's just horseshit that your dog doesn't start to bark and you don't get up and look out the window and go out to help. It's horseshit. And it's consciousness of guilt. Consciousness of guilt. At one point during the early morning hours, Brian Albert called Brian Higgins. And then Higgins called back. And during their federal grand jury testimony, they both tried to say it was a butt dial. But the feds weren't having it. And in a similar agonizing manner, they dragged out of Brian Albert and later Brian Higgins that it is really not possible with an iPhone to butt dial someone. Brian Albert would go on to say that in order to unlock his phone, he has the face recognition. So that's even more than the thumbprint thing that I have. But at a minimum, you have to do something to unlock the phone. And same as with the federal grand jury, he had to ultimately say that it was not a butt dial, that it was intentional. And just the obfuscation of the minor facts in this case makes him look like a liar. And he looks like a liar because he is lying. And this phone call between the two was a plan to get their story straight. And is it a coincidence that these same people who call each other during those early morning hours destroy their phones after being told not to? Like, he is squirming up there. And at certain points, he's looking down. And I'd swear that he's looking at a device or something. And at a certain point, it seems like he was gesturing to somebody in the courtroom. But I don't know, could he have an iWatch on or something like that? But regardless, his testimony was untruthful at best, perjurious at worst. I think I just invented a word there. The cell phone issues came after Alan Jackson eviscerated Brian Albert for lying about knowing Karen Reed. Alan Jackson directly asked him, isn't it true that 6 days before John O'Keefe died, you met with Karen and John O'Keefe? And he blatantly says no. And that's when the defense produces the picture that was taken by Karen Reed. Karen Reed still had that photograph and gave it to the defense naturally. So she took the photograph standing right in front of this group 6 days before John passed. So is that perjury or a forgetful mind? You make the call, like they used to say in the NFL. I think a lot of these prosecution witnesses are falling into the trap where they never agree to the simplest things by the defense. And the defense latches on to that because it just makes you look like a liar. Could he have said that he knew Karen Reed? What difference would it have made? Just tell the truth. But they're always looking to lie and distance themselves. And boom, here's a picture. Boom, here's perjury. You dig? And after Alan Jackson brought up the federal grand jury, which you can't name in front of this current Commonwealth jury, he just broke. You know, there's the photograph and you lied. Man, what the hell? Why didn't you just say you knew them? Yeah, we were friendly. I liked them. And he said that about John. I don't know why he didn't want to say that about Karen. But everybody is trying to distance themselves from everybody else. Katie McLaughlin, the paramedic, the same way. And I think this is Adam Lally's fault because all these same witnesses stated that they were not prepped for this trial by Adam Lally or a second chair. And I don't get it. There's no problem with Katie McLaughlin saying Caitlin Albert is my friend. There's no problem with Brian Albert saying I was friendly with Karen Reed. But they don't want to say yes to anything. And it makes everything else larger because it appears like you're being untruthful. And you know who would know that? Prosecutor Adam Lally. But this team, the prosecution team, seems allergic to working weekends or overtime on this case. Well, the defense is not, and it shows in spades. So in a similar vein as to when Brian Albert was trying to distance himself from Karen Reed in that photograph, when she took that photograph 6 days before John O'Keefe died, the same thing happens with the video at the waterfall. In his grand jury testimony, I think both of them at the state and at the federal grand juries, he stated that although he was at the waterfall with Karen present, he didn't have much interaction with her. But the defense puts on the video and it shows them appearing to talk. You know, it just looks like they're talking and they probably were, but he ran from that as well. And why would you say that? He is fearful of coming off untruthful or perjurious, as I've said before, about what his previous testimony. The problem is, when you're telling the truth, you don't have to remember what you said before because it's just the truth. He's having a tough time keeping his story together. And the video at the waterfall was especially damning, because he's leaning over to talk to Karen directly. His response on the stand, and it was not convincing, was, I may have been talking to somebody to the left, right, or somewhere else. The jury's not buying it. Nobody's buying it. But one thing you have to know, the Alberts don't care if Karen Reed gets acquitted. They care about if any of them get charged. If they all walk out free people, believe me, that's a victory, especially for Brian Albert. There had been some speculation before Brian Albert's testimony that they'd bring up the fact that he's been involved in several altercations. One we've heard about previously, he got into a street beef with another Boston cop by the name of Hernandez, and I think he was punished for it. But what had come out more recently was, I think this was through Sean McDonough, Sean on the Gulf, if you want to look him up on YouTube or Twitter. It's worth the research. What McDonough says is, at one point, and there are photographs, Brian got into a street beef with a fireman. And it was, I think, a verbal argument at J.J. Foley's in Boston South End. And he hit this fireman with a bottle, like a beer bottle, right in the face and ran out the bar to an awaiting car. And there's some photographs of this kid. And he is basically all jacked up in the face. And I hadn't heard much about that altercation. I've heard about others, but not about this one. And there's other massive conduct issues with Brian on the BPD. And I think that's one of the reasons he retired from the Boston police just after this incident occurred. Again, we've discussed the post-incident behavior. They sell the house at below market rate. They have the floors done before they sell the house. They got rid of their pet of 7 years after the incident, and so on and so on. So my point in all that rambling was that information didn't make it into the court record. I think they had their hands full. I mean, he was a tough witness, but he looked like a liar ultimately, where you're just fighting against everything. And then they're putting up pictures and video. It just didn't go well. And it's about what we thought. I thought they would get into more of the violence Brian had been involved in on the Boston Police Department, but I think they made a command decision that they didn't need it, because at one point, the questioning around the telephones got so intense that the judge had to call a recess in lieu of voir dire. And that's an inquiry without the jury present. That's not the direct translation, but that's how I know it. And during the voir dire, Brian Albert got to go out and talk to his personal attorney. You know, so I think they were on the fence about pleading the fifth on the phone issue, because I think it's going to be big on the federal level. And don't forget, I believe the feds are all looking at what all these people say under oath, and it has to match up what they said at the federal grand jury. So I think Brian Albert may be in a little trouble, but we'll see. You know, it is still Massachusetts. All right, guys, so I'm going to say Brian Albert's testimony didn't go over well, and at least from my perspective, that does seem to be the consensus of the talking heads on the various networks that are covering this, both on normal TV and the internet, YouTube, whatever else. But he come off as a liar, and Alan Jackson basically said that. He called him a liar. And he wasn't a bad witness. He wasn't stuttering. He wasn't really getting red in the face. But at times he was flustered. And I don't think he was believable. You know, you don't come out of your house when there is a circus with sirens and police on your front lawn. It's simply hard to believe. And as just a layperson, if I was a juror, I'd be like, I don't buy that for a second. Also, it didn't come out that he did not attend John's wake and funeral. I mean, what the hell? And don't forget, he was on the way home. The day John O'Keefe died, Brian Higgins and Brian Albert were returning from a police officer's funeral whom they did not know. You have a Boston police officer who died on your lawn, whom you were out with that very night, and you don't go to his funeral? Come on. That was not displayed for the jury, but that is a fact. The whole butt dialing thing, that was taken care of in court. And it was just a bullshit story. And that's how it come across. You can't really butt dial from an iPhone anymore. That's a vestige of time past. You've got to open your phone. You've got to choose somebody in your favorites or dial it manually. And that just didn't come off well at all for this guy. All right, but let's move on from Brian Albert. I'm going to speed it up a little bit. I took a lot of time on Brian Albert because he is a crucial witness, and he's a prosecution witness whom I believe was turned in favor of the defense and who really didn't damage Karen Reed at all. His distancing of Karen Reed in that photograph, it was just a lie, because the photograph depicts them all together 6 days prior to John's death. All right, guys. So the next witness on Monday following Brian Albert Sr. was Brian Albert Jr. He is a big, tall guy, but in terms of demeanor is much different from his dad. He says he suffers from anxiety and all this. And Brian's 25 years old, lives at home with mom and dad, and is involved in the computer industry, IT, I guess you'd call it, and kind of seems like a good kid, laid back, you know, not super aggressive. Again, I had mentioned he suffered from anxiety, but I don't know. The Commonwealth could have gotten away with not calling him because, again, it's just another witness to say he didn't see a body on the lawn. At one point, his friend Julie Nagel went out to talk to her brother, Ryan Nagel, who was going to pick Julie up and take her home. She ended up staying. And at that point, he looked out and saw what is believed to be Karen's black SUV, sort of near the flagpole. And he looked all that way and didn't see a body. And that would become a recurring theme with the Commonwealth going forward. People coming out of 34 Fairview and not seeing the body when it should be right in front of you. He's 6 feet tall, John, 6 feet tall, 200 some odd pounds. I just don't buy it. And he'd go on to say that when the police came and the sirens, the lights are blaring, people are talking. At one point, I think there was 15, 16 people on the front lawn. He doesn't see any of it. The dog's not going nuts. I just don't buy it. And I don't know if I've mentioned it before. I've got a mixed breed who anytime Amazon delivers a package, you know, the dog thinks they're protecting us from an invasion. And it goes absolutely apeshit. So when there's flashing lights and people running feet from your doorway, you don't exit. This goes for Brian Jr. too, right? And even when he's told in the morning by his father what had happened on the front lawn, he still doesn't look out the window. He didn't really offer much in the way of evidence for the Commonwealth. Again, I don't know why Lally called him. Again, didn't offer much, and also admitted that he never really saw Colin Albert leave the residence. Those are the things that the Commonwealth should know is going to come into the record, because he never really saw Colin leave. And that jacks up his timeline, and that would become apparent later. So I don't know. I believe he was turned a little bit in favor of the defense, Brian Albert Jr., because again, he reports he doesn't know when Colin left. He saw no body on the lawn. And it's just not believable to me that that happens on the lawn in the early morning hours. And there's photographs from other neighbors. It looks like a crime scene, a massive crime scene with a ton of cops. And you don't know that's happening. Bullshit. Also, guys, it highlighted the intentionally, in my view, an intentionally crappy investigation by the police. Brian Albert Jr. was not interviewed for 18 months. After John O'Keefe's homicide, 18 months, despite cops being there that very morning, the next day, 18 months, more than a year, guys. That, my friends, is complete horseshit. But I don't believe that this was a crucial witness for the Commonwealth, But again, all those intricacies, right, of not being interviewed for 18 months, not seeing the body when there wasn't much snow on the ground, when you were looking directly in that direction, I think that harmed the Commonwealth. Again, there is not a lot of evidence going into the record to date about what happened to John O'Keefe. And it continued with this kid, Brian Albert Jr. All right, I'm going to leave him there. We went on to Caitlin Albert after that, and we'd end Monday with Caitlin's testimony. It was a long day. But I think as Monday ended, the takeaway was Brian Albert was just simply not credible, was a liar, close to perjury at times, I believe. And Brian Jr., either way, he seemed credible. You know, he didn't seem like he was lying, but he didn't have a lot to offer either. But again, highlighting those negatives in the investigation over and over again. 18 months to interview somebody who was in the house when a Boston cop was killed on his lawn. I don't know. How would you take it if you were on the jury? I know how I'd take it. This was intentional. This is malfeasance. But we went on to Caitlin Albert, and they went back and forth on cross about her connection to paramedic Katie McLaughlin, who at one point during this trial, who I thought she was probably the worst witness I've ever seen ever in any trial. Caitlin, they got into it a little bit, but as the day ended and there was an objection, I believe, the next morning, Tuesday morning, they'd have a bit of a hearing as to what would come in regarding photographic evidence between the paramedic McLaughlin and her relationship with Caitlin Albert. And on Tuesday, it would get supremely interesting. And guys, by interesting, I don't mean Prosecutor Lally's direct interrogation, but on cross-examination. And as I had mentioned before, prior to this, there was a bit of a hearing, and Judge Bev said she'd decide on a photograph-by-photograph basis as to which photographs would be allowed in. This was kind of torturous. And on cross-examination, they impeached paramedic McLaughlin's testimony with Caitlin's testimony, and they both came off, in my humble opinion, as being untruthful. This was so unnecessary, and I put this on Lally, just not preparing these witnesses. He should have told the paramedic, Katie McLaughlin, that it's okay to know people in town. She knew the house she was at, the owners of the house she was at. I'd bet she was there. But they tried to say, oh, we're only acquaintances. And actually, McLaughlin said when she was on the stand, I went to high school with somebody named Caitlin Albert. And just trying to distance herself from saying she's friends with the Alberts, and it just came off as unnecessary. Lally should have told her, that's fine. It would have saved, I don't know, half a day's testimony, and just, it made the Commonwealth look like, in both instances, paramedic McLaughlin and Caitlin, that they were liars, and they don't have to lie. You can be friends. And since Katie McLaughlin's testimony, over that weekend, more photographs came out as to about 8 months before John passed, they were photographed together at a baby shower. So this is not limited. Their friendship is not limited to high school. And in these photographs, some of them, they have their arms around each other. One, which I don't think was allowed in, they were in a hot tub together. So just these lies, these strange little lies that we're not friends but acquaintances. It just makes all your other testimony look like horseshit. And that's what the defense successfully did, and turned them both into liars. And they didn't have to appear like that to the jury. And I place that wholly on Adam Lally. But that was mostly Caitlin's impact here. And then we went on to Caitlin's boyfriend, Tristan Morris. And when I had told you that paramedic McLaughlin may have been the worst witness I've ever seen, she was soon supplanted by this guy, Tristan Morris. He comes in, he's squared away, clean cut, and a good-looking guy. And not the same guy we'd seen threatening like a week before, threatening Turtle Boy down at Castle Island in South Boston. And he had a different demeanor. But on cross-examination, guys, you can skip most of his direct examination by Lally. Lally is just, man, it's torturous with this cat. It just really is. But on cross, this guy lost all memory. He has Canton amnesia. He wouldn't say anything. What time were you at the waterfall bar? I don't recall. And so the defense just hammers him. They hammer him, and he looks like a moron. He looks like a dummy. And I notice he's got a beautiful watch on. And I wish the defense had said, well, why do you wear that watch? He said, I don't know, 50 times, just to the basic questions. What time did you leave the waterfall? I don't know. I'm not going to tell you what time I don't know. And they get into this whole thing. Could it have been midnight? And he's like, oh, it could have been, I don't know, 5 a.m. He was just belligerent and stupid. And he fell right into a trap. And his testimony will be remembered forever in the annals of Massachusetts trials. I'll tell you that. It was horrific. I'll put it in the show notes. Grab a cup of coffee, or maybe you could put something in a Boston Confidential tumbler and watch his testimony, and you'll see how bad it really was. So I guess Caitlin, toward the middle of her testimony, said they were at the waterfall bar together, and that's fine, right? But Tristan had to leave early because he was going to plow. He plows on the side, and this was going to be a huge snowstorm. So he left there and went back to their apartment and, you know, wanted to get some rest before the heavy snow set in. But sometime later, she calls him and says, come and get me. I want to come home. And that was kind of strange because the plan was somebody else was going to take her, or she was going to stay at 34 Fairview. And Tristan, at one point, they go back and forth on cross-examination, and he had the line of the day, and he said Caitlin was kind of high maintenance, and the entire courtroom cracked up. But again, both of these witnesses, at, I think it was, you know, 12:45 or something close to that, also didn't see John's body on the lawn. And I think this is 3 or 4 witnesses who have that same type of testimony. But Tristan Morris came off either as a liar or a dummy, and however you want to take it. So when he falls into this trap, Tristan Morris falls into this I don't know trap, David Yannetti tries to build, I don't know, some type of context where it would refresh his memory. And man, he just come off as an idiot. And I know it's repetitive, right? But this was so bad. This was the worst witness I've ever seen. Again, supplanting Katie McLaughlin. He wasn't as belligerent, but he wasn't budging on times. He basically says, I don't know, like basically much about times. And things that you should remember, that you would remember, you just look like a liar to the jury. And that's exactly what happened. Exactly what happened. Your memory isn't that bad. It wasn't that bad on direct examination, that's for sure. So Yannetti does a masterful job playing up the fact that the kid's a dunce and hammers him. At a certain point, I thought Lally should have objected just to say, hey, the witness said he doesn't know times. But he didn't. And Yannetti just kept on and on with it. But he also testified he saw no body. And this is at 1:45 a.m. John should have been on that lawn, dead or dying. And they didn't see him. And the headlights, both Caitlin and Tristan stated that the headlights would have went over that direct area. And John was not there, or the body of John was not there. Or at least they didn't see it. So again, it just comes off as unbelievable. And Tristan Morris did the Commonwealth no favors. He was horrible. He looked like a liar. He looked like a dunce. He was basically a witness for the defense. And I don't know if people in Canton realize that, but it was horrid. It's stunning to me how thus far in the trial, how many of the Commonwealth's witnesses come off as untruthful. And this is the prosecution case. This is their opportunity to tell you how this happened. They seem to be doing everything they can to protect the witnesses in this case and very little to convict Karen. There's not a lot of focus. We haven't heard from any state trooper who investigated this homicide. You think you'd hear from them first. We all know they've been compromised because of the TUI information. And I think they're trying to hide the troopers in this case. When the defense comes on, they're not going to be able to do that. Things were going to get worse for the Commonwealth on this Tuesday. And I don't think a day could have went any worse. But I think I've said that before in this podcast, it gets worse as the week goes on. And the best day the Commonwealth has had was opening statements. And this is what, day 11. So not going well for the Commonwealth, I'll have to say that. So guys, next on the prosecution's witness list was Sarah Levinson. And she was at the party for Brian Albert Jr. She's a friend of his. She is a nurse. I believe she had recently completed her degree and she works at a hospital on the South Shore. She seemed very, very nervous. And the direct examination of Sarah Levinson, again, you have to wonder why she was called. She didn't really provide much on direct. On cross-examination, again, this is the third or fourth witness in a row on this Tuesday that has stated that she never saw a body on the lawn. And she left the residence at about 1:45 with Matthew McCabe. He was driving. McCabe's wife was in the passenger seat. Sarah Levinson was in back, along with Julie Nagel. And again, by this time, the Commonwealth claims that John O'Keefe was lying dead on the lawn. They didn't see him. They got into a vehicle whose lights would have went directly across the body. They didn't see anybody. Nobody in that vehicle reported seeing a body. That would change with the next witness. But what Sarah Levinson, again, she gave the defense the fact that there was no body, nothing on the lawn was out of the ordinary, and really that's it. She provided the Commonwealth really nothing. Again, why are you calling her? Is it because you're afraid you'll look like you're hiding something? I'm not sure. So a lot of people think Sarah Levinson's testimony was kind of meaningless, but I picked up on something, and I think others have as well. When the cops first arrived and followed by the paramedics and EMTs, they said there was 6 inches of snow under John O'Keefe. Now, Sarah Levinson said it was really just a dusting, and she could see some patches of green on the lawn. But don't forget, at 1:45 a.m., the Commonwealth alleges John had been on the lawn for about an hour. And when the first responders got there, 6 inches of snow underneath them, but just the dusting on top. How do you explain that? And again, I think I already mentioned it. 4 people leaving 34 Fairview at 1:45. Nobody reported that they saw anything out of the ordinary. That was the question on the lawn. 4 people driving by. Again, the headlights sweep that area. You would likely have seen a body. Nobody saw one. Nobody reported it. That would change. That would change with the next witness, and I believe she perjured herself. The next witness was Julie Nagel. She was also a friend of Brian Albert Jr., and she was there for the party. And at one point, she had called her brother for a ride. Ryan Nagel, her brother, showed up with a friend. They were in a pickup truck. Again, he pulls up behind Karen's car and doesn't report seeing anybody else in the cabin of the SUV. And the dome light was on. So he reports only seeing Karen in there. If Karen's alone in the vehicle, where's John? You know, deductive reasoning would say he's in the house. But let's stick with Julie Nagel. I believe what honestly happened with Julie Nagel is something happened inside the house. That's why she called for a ride to get out of there. And when her brother arrived, somebody in the house said, no, we're going to put this on lockdown. Tell him to go away and we'll take you home. That's what I believe happened. That hasn't been entered into evidence. I want to make that clear. That is my opinion, my belief. But when she goes out to talk to her brother, Ryan, and tell him, basically, I'm going to stay, she sees the lawn. Again, there's nobody on the lawn, according to her testimony. But she states when she's leaving, and this is where I believe her testimony becomes perjurious. She says at the end of this, at the end of her direct examination by Mr. Lally, that she saw what she described as a big blob. First, I think at one point she described it as a big object. Her testimony morphs into it was a big blob, a 5 or 6 foot blob. And she said she had mentioned that to the other people in the SUV she was a passenger in, which would have included Sarah Levinson and both the McCabes, Matt McCabe and his wife, right? So none of those people report hearing her say that. And the courtroom erupted. It was all a flutter. So on cross-examination, she gets torn to shreds. She had never mentioned that to the state police. She said the next day, her testimony was, the next day I realized it was John O'Keefe that I had witnessed. And man, this is where the perjury comes in. It's so strange to me. During previous hearings, the defense filed a motion saying nobody had seen John's body on the lawn. And that's a big hole in the prosecution's theory. And then a few days later, that's when Julie Nagel says, I saw an object on the lawn. It just doesn't pass the laugh test. She went on to say that she realized it was John's body the next morning when this was all over TV. And she never picked up the phone to call the Canton police. She never alerted the state police, but she was claiming she saw John's body. And I think it was David Yannetti who just tore her a new, you know what. and stated, this is the first time you're telling anybody any of this. Isn't that correct? And she had to admit it was. And it was a blockbuster moment. I mean, that's the conspiracy here. There's the conspiracy among the so-called witnesses. It was complete and utter horseshit. And the jury had to have picked up on it. She had never mentioned to the state police when she was interviewed, I saw an object on the lawn. And then it morphs into a 5 foot, 6 foot blob. That's what she called it. And she said she had mentioned it to others in the SUV. They don't report that. Complete horseshit. If she said that, they would have stopped. They would have stopped. Come on. If she had reported this the next day, I believe I saw John's body on the lawn, I'd believe her. But she didn't. And she tells nobody about it. Just complete and utter horseshit. I'm sorry. And that's how she's going to go down in infamy. So that was the last witness of Tuesday. And on Wednesday, I think she was on the stand for redirect, and Lally redirected her about the blob and all this other stuff. But again, Yannetti comes back and says, because on redirect, she says, that's when I became aware and I realized that that black blob was John O'Keefe. Yannetti tears her apart and says, you realize that was John O'Keefe and you never called the police. You never called the police. For months, she never said that. And then when she was finally interviewed, I think she called it a blob. And that was in response to the defense had just filed a motion saying that nobody had seen a body on the lawn. Again, I think I had said it doesn't pass the laugh test. And her demeanor from one moment from direct examination to cross, her face is red. She's kind of pursing her lips and biting her lips. And she said she had said this to people in the vehicle. None of them reported it. She said she had realized it was John the next day when it was all over the news. And if she had reported that to the Canton police, I saw something there. I didn't know what it was. I would have believed her. But come on. And then this thing morphs into a blob because she couldn't come out and say, I saw his body on the lawn and did nothing about it. But even when she does acknowledge, I realized it was John O'Keefe, she doesn't report it to the police. I didn't buy it. Nobody I knew bought it, and I'm sure the jury did not buy it whatsoever. I urge you to take a look at this. It's perjury to me. It just is. And Adam Lally was a part of it. So we're on Wednesday of the week, guys, and the next witness was a DNA expert, a veterinarian DNA expert, and her name was Coons, and she was very good, right? But again, on cross-examination, the defense really made a hell of a case for garbage in, garbage out, if you remember that from your computer classes. If it's not submitted correctly, the results will be off. And I think the defense kind of negated what she said. What she ended up saying is they tested, I believe, two pieces of clothing. And the clothing wasn't sent to the lab, only swabs were. So remember the red Solo cups in this case where the blood just evaporated, right? And how horrible that was. This expert couldn't get into that, but the defense did kind of get that in to remind the jury of the state of the forensics in this case. They sent, again, the swabs and not the clothing. I think that was a mistake. And it came out later that one piece of clothing had no canine DNA, and the other swab, at least, had pig DNA. Can you believe that? Right? That's kind of inexplicable. And the defense kind of laid the foundation for the fact that a lot of dogs, especially big dogs, my dog included, they have these snacks or, you know, play toys that are pig ears. And that was objected to all over the place. But that's a fact. My dog has them and he loves them. He goes crazy over them. But I don't believe that the expert really harmed the defense all that much because, again, garbage in, garbage out. I don't know. I'd still say that was turned to the defense. The Commonwealth was looking for her to say that, you know, no dog DNA was found. But we're going to hear later in the trial that the Commonwealth did take tissue samples and they disappeared from John's arm. That didn't come into play this week, but I believe it will later. So Nagel, I believe, was turned against the prosecution. She was lying. It was pretty obvious, you know. You don't go to the police saying, I saw something. I think it was John's body the next day. Horseshit. Complete horseshit. But the veterinarian DNA expert, you know, she was good and squared away, but it's how the evidence was presented to her that the defense attacked. And I think they did a good job. The defense did get her, the expert there, to admit the fact that if the samples were degraded or obtained or packaged incorrectly, garbage in, garbage out. It's just that simple. And we saw what happened with the taillights, the red Solo cup, the Stop and Shop bags. I mean, I don't know. It was a bit laughable. But that expert was actually pretty brief on the stand. She did do pretty well, but again, they got her to admit if the samples were contaminated or obtained incorrectly, that it's garbage in, garbage out. So as a prosecution witness, I don't know how effective she was, but I don't know. So the next three witnesses, the trio, people are calling them, Ryan Nagel, Heather Maxson, and Ryan's buddy. And they all tell basically the same story. They had arrived at 34 Fairview to pick up Julie Nagel, that's Ryan's sister. And when they get there, they have a conversation. She comes out of the house and speaks to them at the pickup truck they were driving. But as they arrived, guys, this was the time where Karen was arriving because they arrived basically at the same time. The pickup truck kind of waved on Karen's SUV at that time, and it pulled up in front of the pickup truck. And we kind of had known what Ryan was going to say, and he was a good witness. He was an honest guy, an honest kid. What his testimony was is, you know, they arrived, you know, almost simultaneously. Nobody saw John get out of the car, but at a certain point, Karen, a woman with long hair, it's believed to be Karen, and that was the SUV. There was nothing wrong. They all said there was nothing wrong with her taillights. She puts the dome light on at one point, and there's only one person in the compartment, in the car, in the SUV. John was not visible. Heather, the girlfriend, at one point reports seeing a man in the passenger seat. None of them report a fight, an accident, or they also don't report John walking into 34 Fairview. But they were tied up for about 5 minutes talking to the sister, Julie Nagel. And I don't know what these really offered the Commonwealth. They end up being defense witnesses. They saw nothing on the yard. They saw the vehicle move along the lawn. And at a certain point, Karen's by herself, right? There's only one place really to go. That would be in the house. All three of these witnesses say they didn't see John's body on the lawn. And this is the time where it's alleged to have happened. right? So again, I don't understand. Lally didn't prepare any of these witnesses, because if he had, he would have realized, I'm going to have three people in a row testify that Karen at times was by herself. There was no body on the lawn, nothing out of the ordinary on the lawn. There was no fight. The car did not back up at a high rate of speed, which is the prosecution's case in chief, right? At some point, they allege that Karen backed up intentionally at, what, 24 miles an hour, struck John, and left him there. That hasn't been put into evidence yet. Every time the defense tries to mention that, Lally goes nuts. You know, he doesn't want that in. And nobody has reported seeing that as of yet, that John was struck, that John was on the lawn. And I don't know, three witnesses in a row who say there was no body, Karen was alone at a time, and they were completely defense witnesses. And I guess I'll leave it there. I got to shorten these days up. I know I'm going to get you to Friday, but I'm thinking of changing my format a bit. This is too much to give you guys a whole week's worth of this testimony. I think we're at a little over an hour now. And if you're still with me, you know, I really appreciate it. But every day gets worse for the Commonwealth. And this is Wednesday we're talking about. From Wednesday to Friday, it gets at least two times worse. So the next witness we have, guys, is Allie McCabe. She's the daughter of Jen McCabe and Matt McCabe. And she allegedly picked up Colin Albert from 34 Fairview. And I don't know, her testimony, I'm just really not buying it. They show some screenshot, and I don't know how this got into evidence, because a screenshot is simply a photograph. It's a photograph of a text exchange where Colin Albert texted Miss McCabe to come pick her up, but it can't be examined. And the defense would go on to say it could have been doctored. And then the photograph, then the screenshot is taken. And Allie doesn't remember when she took the screenshot. I thought her testimony would go pretty smoothly, but it didn't. It went off the rails on cross-examination, at any rate. David Yannetti gets into the Life 360 app, which is basically a spyware app that parents use to find out where their kids are and all that. I'm sure you're familiar with it. I don't know how accurate it is. I would assume it's pretty accurate, because otherwise, why would you use it? But the data from the 360 app doesn't line up with Allie McCabe's testimony. And she seems flummoxed over it when it doesn't. You can see her demeanor change. The Life 360 app, quite frankly, impeaches her testimony and her credibility. If that's accurate, she was out till 1:30 driving around Canton. And something's up with that, because she said she dropped Colin home. And the time just doesn't really add up with the 360 app. And later, Allie McCabe would end up in tears. Somehow, the judge allowed in some evidence that there had been some harassment, not by Karen Reed, but the jury didn't know who was doing the harassing of the McCabes, Colin, all of them. And she started crying. So she became quite sympathetic. But from what I hear, at least from one person who was watching the jury in the courtroom, that they really didn't bite on it. They didn't get emotional when Allie did. But she did let it slip why this was happening. Because she said something like, and it's very quick, I'll try to put it in the show notes, that Colin wasn't in the house when John O'Keefe was, or words to that effect. And that belies the prosecution mightily. And that's when she starts with the waterworks. The judge said Yannetti had creeped up to open that door by asking her why she hadn't submitted the screenshot to the state police for over a year. I believe it's over a year, 8 months, a year, something like that. And they said that opened the door for them to talk about this harassment. And she started crying and all that. But you want to know what, guys? Let me leave you here. I've dumped a lot of information. I'll pick it up next week from Allie McCabe's testimony, because after Allie McCabe, we get to Colin Albert. And that was a blockbuster. And you're not going to want to miss that. And Monday, don't forget this Monday, we're off. The trial doesn't resume until Tuesday. So let me leave you there. I apologize for dumping this all in your lap at once. I'm going to make a revision to the format, and maybe you'll see me more than once a week. You dig? All right. I'm going to leave you there. I'm going to get on to the next one. Next week, I'll be covering the same case, and we'll go from there. All right. Go buy a tumbler from my shop at BostonConfidentialGear.com. That's BostonConfidentialGear.com. And I want you to do it right now. I know you meant to do it last week, and I'm reminding you, here I am. All right, guys. See you on the flip side.